Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
Hey guys, welcome back to Magic TV. My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock, which means it's time to talk magic. And today I have somebody on the channel that I have been trying to interview since I started Magic TV. This is somebody that I know very, very well. He is an incredible person. He's a bit grumpy, but he's an incredible person. Very, very entertaining, incredible magician, huge backstory. He's basically a legend in the British magic community.
Most of the British magic community have never heard of me, Craig.
I am, of course, talking about Alec Powell, the man, the myth, the legend. How are you doing, Alec?
I'm all right, thanks, considering.
It's fair to say that you're very, very excited about doing this interview, aren't you?
Right. I'm absolutely incandescent with enthusiasm.
Thank you for doing it. I don't think I've ever seen you do an interview ever, so I really appreciate
you. Well, it's because I've never done one ever.
Well, I really appreciate it. And there's a lot that we've got to talk about, obviously, and we're going to get to this in a bit, but you've got Kidology coming up. You've got the 2022 Kidology. But there's been an awful lot that you've done in your career. I only know a small part of it, but you've done a lot. Like, as a performer, you've done illusions, you've done close-up, you've done kids shows, you've done workshops, you're a dealer. You've basically done it all and then some. I mean, you've had so many hats that you've worn throughout your time in magic.
The problem is not many of them fitted.
Well, I want to know where it all started. How did you get into magic? How old were you? I mean, I don't even know that. Was it like a case of having a coin pulled from behind your ear when you were 3 years old? What's your origin story?
When I was 3 years old, I can't remember what I had for breakfast, let alone what was happening when I was 3 years old. I suppose, like the vast majority of people say, it was a David Nixon magic set. That, I suppose, fascinated me a bit. I can't really remember, but I know by the time I went to secondary school, I'd done a few shows here and there in the garage with my sister, best forgotten, bringing all the family in and all that palaver. But then I went to grammar school. It's probably because of me they abolished the 11 plus. Because my time at school was disastrous, and I hated it most every minute of it. In fact, the only thing I liked about school was the bus home. But it was there, I think, for the Baskerville Society. I did a first sort of major stage thing with on the school variety show when I was, I think, 11 or 12, and it was 3.5 minutes. Of absolute crap. And I can remember quite vividly now what was in the act. In fact, some of it I'm still doing. But things developed a bit, and there was a local newspaper that had a column written by a Canadian journalist called Auntie Pat. And she put in the paper, she wanted some performers to go and do some concert party stuff. So I replied to that and then became the head of the Auntie Pat concert party quite quickly, doing all sorts of rubbish. But we put together this little concert party, and we went around various institutions. And I think by the time I was 13 or 14, I was doing Swallowing the Razor Blades, because I've got a press cutting with me doing it, Great trick. I did that for a very long time. Not very well, but I did it for a long time. And, it was about 10 shilling 50p from Davenport's at the time. with three sets of blades. A guy advised me early on, said, get rid of the middle set, don't switch those in, just keep the sharp ones. Now, this is interesting. Yeah, so I only have it, so I'd get a straw or cardboard and demonstrate them and put it straight in your mouth. So there was no switching of that blade, because the first one's a bit tricky, but after that, the spit in your mouth makes the blades stick together, and so they don't cut you. Well, not badly anyway, but so there you go. Don't recommend anybody else doing it, but that's what I did. And I digress. So there was the Auntie Pat thing, and you know, the old church social and stuff like that, till I left school and I went to work for a solicitor called Bert Millership in West Bromwich.
So was the goal to, so you let you, you were performing all through school, but then you kind of went into a proper job. Was the goal to have a proper job, and how did that end up not working out? How did you
come? Well, it took 30 years not to work out. Actually, I left school midway through A-levels. I'd really had enough. And I went to see the headmaster, and I said, I'm going to leave school on Friday. He said, but David, we've hired a costume for you for Iolanthe. And I said, A, my name's not David, and B, I couldn't give monkeys about your Iolanthe. Anyway, so I went to work for Bert Millership, a solicitor in West Bromwich, who was at that time, he was chairman of West Bromwich Albion and chairman of the FA, which is ironic, really, because that's pretty much what he paid me. And no, you don't have to, Craig. £5 a week. And that's before stoppages. I only had to do Saturday, but I lost my Saturday job because I had to do Saturday mornings and that. My first day at work, they said, right, the managing clerk went, right, he takes two sugars, he takes one, all the secretary, 25 cups of tea. Anyway, made the tea. He said, right, you're going to court this morning. And he gave me this file of papers about that thick. And I said, where? He said, the High Court in Birmingham. And I said, well, I don't know where that is. He said, Birmingham. I said, no, the High Court, I don't know where. He said, I'm going to tie a label onto your coat. I said, well, I'll just, and he said, it's a defended divorce in the High Court. And he said, there you go. Anyway, here's your bus fare. And that was the end of my legal training. And he said, ask for this barrister called Alan something or other. Anyway, I'll get into this enormous, you know, Victoria Law Court, in enormous building, 20-odd courts. I'm terrified. I'm 16 or 17. And eventually found the court and the barrister, and he said, no, is our client here? I said, no idea. I said, look, it's my first day at work. He says, oh, and he looked after me. But that was the start of it. And it was pretty much downhill from there. Sorry.
Right, mate.
So I worked there for a couple of years, still doing a little bit of magic. It was around, no, I missed out an important bit before I left school. I joined the Wolverhampton Circle of Magicians.
Okay.
So, see, a lot of these things overlap, makes it confusing for me. But, yeah, and a guy called Pete Jeffries, who was the secretary there, brilliant, funny man, made a lot of electronic stuff. He got me in, basically. They hadn't got a junior section, and I think some of the old gits there weren't very happy about me joining, but he got me in. And I loved it those days. I loved that. I never missed a meeting, you know. Mm. And what was different then to now, we had like one or two lectures a year, one deal a dem, and the whole rest of the program, met once a fortnight, was stuff they did themselves, competitions or theme nights, and it was great. It was a great time. And I think most magic clubs have lost that now. You put a club night on, nobody turns up, you know. You put Intergalactic Stella from America on and everybody piles out. To watch him do stuff that they'll never be able to do, whether they buy it or not, you know. And in those days, you learnt a lot of stuff, and you it was a great social atmosphere there as well. That was the thing that I noticed about the IBM match. I felt there was a good social ring to it all.
It felt really welcoming.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, I digress. I've carried on in the law for a long time. Worked at two different firms. It was a general litigation knockabout solicitor's clerk. And then I went to work for the prosecuting solicitor's department in Birmingham. I was there when the pub bombs went off. That was quite a hairy time. Well, I was in Birmingham that night, actually, as well, because we... Anyway, don't need to talk about that. And I spent quite a long time there. I can't remember how long, 10, 15 years. Came out of the law, went back in, and then specialised in children's law. When the Children Act came in, mainly public law, you know, children are taken into care or representing the parents or the kids it varied. So that was like my main job until around about 2000.
Were you still doing magic, by the way, during that period of time, or had you?
Well, yeah, throughout. I mean, well, there was a period when I dropped out altogether for about 10 years. I was running a youth organisation in West Bromwich, a boys brigade company that had a band. We won the national band championships. And then we took the band out of the boys brigade. It became an American-style joint bugle corps called the Beachmen. And it was a bit of a crazy mob. They were great guys. We wore long, full-length, bright yellow coats, coachman's coats with black fedoras. And we got a big following all over the country and, you know, went abroad to Holland and France, Germany once. But mainly competing. And so we had a single show that we worked on the whole year. And the last year that the band operated, because I shut it down, we did a circus theme. And so I got a lot of the kids taught how to juggle and stilt walkers, unicycles. So as I was thinking of coming out of the whole banding thing, I saw Fred Van Buren's show. With Andrew was with him, but Fred was still performing then in West Bromwich. And that he bought his outdoor rig, and I thought I could make one of those, you know. So we built an outdoor circus ring, a full 42-foot fence, backdrop, and that built up off a 52-seater coach. And when the band shut down, we put a circus show together and went out on the road doing carnival town shows and whatever. And I did an illusion act for that. And because everybody had to double up to make circus pay, we all had to do more than one act. So we then created the Amnesia Magic Company. And there were four of us in that, my wife, and another girl, and Jimmy Miller, guy from Ireland, very, very funny guy. And this was the Amnesia Magic Company was a silent act. And we went into quite a few competitions with that. It was never a commercial act, four people in it with a 15-minute act, where are you going to book that in, you know. But it worked in the circus, and that was how it came about. And we won a few trophies. We won, comedy awards. We did the IBM a few times, and I know we won the comedy award, and we got a place, and then we won it one year. I've looked that up. Don't know what year it was. We got the money, and we got a certificate, but they withheld the shield because Jeffrey Atkins said the standard wasn't high enough. I was a bit irritated about that, but you know me, I'm not a volatile person. And we won the comedy award at Blackpool, and got the Ken Dodd Comedy Award, which was very nice. And then years later, when I was working on my own, I won the Ken Dodd Comedy Award again at Blackpool.
I mean, that's amazing. So, well, very quickly, so when you mentioned did the circus, that's when you came out of law. You were doing the band.
No, that's overlaps. I was still doing the law.
You were still doing the law while you were running a full circus.
Well, that was the outdoor, yeah, and later, because I bought a big top. I just thought, that's a good idea. So I bought a 650-seater big top. All I'd got of it was a photograph, and I'd never put one up. And this guy said, this is what it looks like when it's up. I said, great. Gave him the money, and we just towed it away. And then I got it home. I thought, bloody, I couldn't do it. It was a mess. And I tracked down the guy who made the tent, and he came to put it up, and he couldn't put it up. So I had to buy all new steelwork and pulleys and God knows what. So it was about a year after I bought it, we actually got the tent put up. But then we toured that. But I was still in the law. So I'd use a polity, I'd use the firm's phone endlessly. And then we go out most, you know, Fridays, set up, or I'd send an advanced crew out with the tent to put it up wherever possible. Bloody hard work, you know. And then I'd carouse in just to do the finishing bits. But we had some good times with that. It was great. It's a great... Have you ever worked in a big top?
Never.
It's a unique auditorium, amazing, because you're 360, they're all around you, you know. But you know, there's all against the good times, there's the putting the tent up in the rain, taking the tent down in the rain, knocking 3 foot pegs into the ground so there's only 6 inches sticking out, and there's 60 of them, towing the king poles up with a lorry and all that. Not such fun. Used to take us about 12 hours to put the tent up if we were on our own, because there was only about 12 of us there at any given time. Unless my mate, Peter Jolly, who's still touring his circus, great circus family, unless they could come along, then Peter and his two sisters could put the whole thing up in about 2 hours. They're just phenomenal. But they're proper circus, you know. So that went on for some years, and I wasn't sure how long, so I had to look it up. And it was until 2008 when I sold the tent to Jerry Cottle. There's a picture of me with the tent in the background. Can you see that?
Yeah, I can, yeah.
That was the year I sold it. That's the end of the tent, so it's a lot longer than it is wide. Anyway, Jerry Cottle bought it. Lovely bloke. But so all throughout that time, I was... That's the sort of magic I was doing. I rejoined the Wolverhampton Circle at some point, and I joined the BMS and the Magic Circle. Me, Magic Circle. How about that? And then Blackpool, and then left them all.
You're still doing law throughout all of this.
Throughout that, yeah. I packed in finally about 2000 full time, and I did some agency work for the next couple of years. So, yeah.
I mean, that's hard work, running the circus, going and performing, doing an illusion show, going to conventions, all the while doing a job as well. That's mad.
Well, it kept me out of the pub a bit. Not a great deal, but there you go. I don't know. And along the way, I don't know, I did a bit of close-up. Not very well. I've never been comfortable with close-up. You know, I know people make a good living at it, but for me, close-up in restaurants and functions has always been like moving wallpaper to keep people occupied till the waiter brings the next course, you know. That's not a very nice thing to say, is it? There you go.
I know what you know, you're not the only person to say that, and I think a lot of people that work on stage do hold that opinion, because the thing is, I've been to close-up events where there's like 1,000 people in the room, and they've booked me on my own for an hour and a half, and they go, get around all those people. And I just look at the room with all of these people in it, and I'm thinking, this is basically the equivalent of doing a fart on a wind tunnel. You know, it's just going to have no impact on the event. If I wasn't here, people wouldn't even know at all. Like, whilst you never get that with a stage act, when you're on stage, you are the centrepiece of the event, and you know, it lives and dies by how well your show goes.
Well, people have kind of signed up to watch you. When they come for a meal or a dinner, they necessarily, they haven't. really. And that's the bit I always found hard. And if you went to one of these where there's half a dozen magicians and you got so many tables each, and there'd always be one that's got to go and get his table to shout and scream as though he's been the best. And nothing winds me up more. And I'd be working at a table and you hear this hullabaloo. And they go, "What's happened?" I said, "Oh, he always finishes by taking his trousers down," or something like that. Anyway, and then you've got the organizer or the booker or the agent or whatever with a clipboard going, "Yeah, that table over there. That table over there is very happy. There's somebody telling stories. They're all having a laugh and a joke. And I've got to go and kill that and say, 'Excuse me, I'm a magician. Would you like to take a card?'" And unsurprisingly, from time to time, you get told to go and do one. I'm sure you have. Even your greatness
Yeah,
hasn't avoided that.
it's happened, it does happen, and that's the thing with a stage act, with a close-up gig. You go up to a table, even if it's a fantastic table, even if they're the best audience ever, you've only got 5 or 6 minutes with them, then you've got to win them over again. Whilst you go out on stage, you've got everyone at the same time, and you can take them on a journey.
I suppose, yeah, that's it. And everybody's signed up to it, aren't they, really? So we had some good laughs with the well, Gordon Astley, Gordon and myself were on a gig somewhere, and there was one table we're trying to get to, and there was a bloke there giving it loads all the time. You could see people's eyes glaze over, and he was chairman of the board. He wouldn't shut up, giving it, blah blah blah, loud, and doing all his jokes. And in the finish, he got up to go to the toilet. And so Gordon and I got a little table and put it facing the wall in the corner of the room, and moved his place and drink and everything onto this little table, and all the rest of the table moved round to fill up the space. So that when he came back, his place had gone in the little table at the corner. Made me laugh anyway. There you go. It breaks the day up, doesn't it?
So what made you, before we carry on with what happened after the circus got sold, let me ask you another question. What happened to what, or what was the reason you entered all these competitions? During the run of the circus and the Amnesia Magic Company, you were entering various different competitions. You won comedy awards, you won the IBM. What made you decide to do that? Was there a reason that,
I was thinking about that the other day. I'm not sure the answer to that. I mean, it's all about promoting yourself, isn't it, at the end of the day? And you can say it's quite good because it puts you under pressure to work on new stuff and maybe or improve on the stuff you're doing, which is the better option. It's all about peer group acceptance as well, isn't it? About other people in the same going, "Yeah, very good. He's won the award and he's the best," I suppose. Mixture of reasons. But I just enjoy doing them, to be honest with you. And I mean, doing stuff at like, I mean, Blackpool's great. The Horseshoe was a fantastic venue to work in. And the Opera House is a massive challenge. It's such a big stage. So both times I was there, I set about filling it with as much junk as I could. You've seen a bit. God, the second one I did there, the one I won, I can barely watch it. It was so bad. I mean, I don't know what
won,
happened.
Alec. You won.
Eh?
You won.
Well, for a start off, I did the whole act. I didn't give a monkey's. I thought I wasn't that bothered. And I thought, well, we'll just go for it. And instead of doing 10, I don't know, 10 or 12 minutes, I did about 25 minutes, and they didn't fetch me off. And I think, what do you call it? Text, anyway, the technology was just getting going where people could text and stuff. And some bloke wrote, "If Alec Powell had done another trick, I would have hung myself." And I thought, well, the job done. Yeah.
Oh
Good laugh there. I enjoyed the Opera House, completely self-indulgent, and that was when I won the Ken Dodd Award for the second time. I've got to do a bit of work with Ken Dodd, you know.
Well, I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that. In order to get there, let me ask you a question. So you sold the circus in around about 2008.
Yeah.
Is that when you started focusing on a solo act? And that's when you won the Ken Dodd for the second time? Because the first time, it was with the Amnesia Magic Company.
Amnesia, yeah. It was with this group here.
Yeah.
That was, you see that? Yeah.
Look at how young you look there. That was great.
No need for that. There's a picture of the four of us with Ken. That was the first one. That's Jimmy and Janet and Hyacinth and me. I don't know. We did the All Winners show at Blackpool, which was in the... I've got... No, because I couldn't remember, I've got a box, a suitcase out full of trophies, because I can't remember. And I thought, well, at least I'll try and get some dates off them. But the plane's dropped off that one, so I don't know. British Magical Chapter of Comedy, 2007. So that must have been... That must have been the second one, I think.
Okay, so 2007. And that was your solo act. That wasn't the illusion
show? Yeah, that was my solo act, yeah.
So what made you put the solo act together? Was it because you knew that the time with the circus was coming to an end and you wanted to, like... Because it would have been a big end to your life. You know, you were no longer working in law. You put all your time and effort into touring with this circus and putting all of your energy into that. And then you make the decision to sell it. You're kind of in a situation now where it's like, well, what do I do next, right?
The mistake you make is thinking that I ever plan anything. I never started life with a plan. I never went into the law with a plan. And I've kind of drifted into things thinking, oh, that's good. I think we'll have a go at that. Or, you know, they asked me to start a Boys Brigade company. Yeah, okay, I'll do that. And then the marching band, the American drum corps scene, and the circus drifted into it. Never been a great fan of the circus, to be honest. People bring me magazines and they think, oh, you know, so-and-so circus is down the road. I go, yeah, good, let me know what it's like. there was never a conscious plan. The circus... Things seem to me, in my life anyway, to have a lifespan, and they reach a point in time where you go, that's enough. With the marching band, there was a lot of internal friction going on. And so we were at the British Marching Band Championships at Wembley, the indoor arena. And as they're coming off to the arena to great... applause. I had the announcer to say, and that is the final appearance, last performance of the Beachman Drummer Bugle Corps. And they're all going, what did he say? And I thought, yes, that's from me to you boys. Anyway, because these were kids, they were sort of 18, 23 year olds. So that's how that finished. I'd had enough, you know, and there were problems financially with it. But we've got a big old warehouse in West Brom. They went, I thought, let's give the circus a go. And some of the bands stuck together. We had a live band in the circus initially when we were doing the outdoor shows. And I got that big old warehouse where the car boot sale originally started. You may have been. You've been in the old warehouse. And then we bought lorries and it kind of just progressed. And then you get to a point in time where you're going, I was sick and tired of the legal problems relating to putting the circus up. You know, a theatre gets an inspection once a year from health and safety and all the other, you know, jobs with. A circus tent, a big top, at that time anyway, got inspected every time it went up. So you're having to deal with the local health and safety, crew. And I thought, I've had enough of this. And I was getting older and it was getting harder. And so I decided to call it a day, and I put the tent up for sale on the Thursday, and said it's at the Sandwell show at the weekend if you want to see it. And Jerry Cotton was the first person to ring me, that day, and he said, I'll come and see it Saturday morning. I said okay, So a few other people said, oh, yeah, we're coming down, well, you know, and so I thought, yeah, they're coming off of me 15 quid, you know. Jerry came and said, what do you want for that? I told him, that's lock, stock and barrel, generators, lorries, everything, seating, ring, the lot. And he said, a bit much, knocked me down a bit, said, okay. I went, fair enough. He said, well, there's £1,000 deposit. Bring it down to Wookie Hole, which he was then running. I rearranged the date a couple of weeks away. In a couple of weeks, so I did. In the meantime, all the people in the circus were going, you sold it? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why didn't you tell me? Blah, blah, usual stuff. Who you sold it to? I said, Jerry Cottle. They went, ha, you'll never see your money. You've kissed goodbye to that. I went, well, he's left me a deposit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anyway, so I'm getting a bit uneasy. Myself, my pal, we head down to Somerset with the lorry, trailers, everything. And pull into what's the name, and they went, oh, Jerry. Jerry comes over. All right, son, how you doing? He said, you got the keys? I went, yeah, I gave him the keys to the two wagons. And he chucked them at two of his blokes. He said, park them up in the yard. And just saw it all go. I thought, oh, God. And everything's gone. And I've got £1,000. And everybody's telling me, this guy isn't going to pay. And he went, come on, I'll tell you what, have a meal first. Meal first. Pie and chips. I don't know how I ate it. I thought, oh, God, Alec, what have you done there? And all my gear's locked up in the yard. But then, Philip said, did you want your meal? I said, lovely, thanks, Jerry. He took us in the office, and he went, poof, gave me all cash. Whole lot. And he said, and we actually got on very well. And he always used to come and see me at Blackpool, and I made illusions for him and others, you know, bits and pieces. So, yeah, we ended up, so sadly he died, you know, during the bloody pandemic. But lovely man, actually. Had his ups and downs like all of us. So that was that sort of one strand, the circus. The magic side was running in parallel to that in a sort of a way, you know.
So you were doing like solo shows as well as working in the circus?
Yeah, 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 yeah. And then, then another strand which had already come into play then was I decided to get out of the law for a whole bunch of reasons. I had enough of it, you know, and I really, really wanted to get out. So I need something else to do. And somebody said, oh, I'll be a magic dealer. So I thought, yeah, why not? So a firm called Terry and Norm was up for sale. Terry Burgess's old firm. He had sold it on. And I thought, okay. Well, so I bought that, actually, for a ridiculous amount of money, far more than it was worth, and caused me a lot of problems. But, you know, I went away, have a go at it. Bear in mind, at this point in time, I've just bought a business that specialises in producing magic for children's entertainers. And at that point in time, I'd never done a children's show in my life. I didn't even know how the tricks worked that I bought. So, yeah, I know, ridiculous, isn't it? So I started making the stuff and went to the first IBM with a pile of stuff. I couldn't demonstrate because I didn't know what it did, basically. And I put together a kid's show, which was dreadful, I think. But gradually it developed and various agents started sending me work, so I got quite busy with it and got up to speed eventually. But as I say, it was never a plan. It was a thing that just kind of happened. And Terry and Norma changed to Albion Magic because I come from West Bromwich. The only thing people know about West Bromwich is West Bromwich Albion. Albion's a sort of old Roman name for England. And also I didn't want people ringing up and saying, is Norma there? You know, because the firm was called Terry and Norma. So there it was. That was how Albion came about. And
off the back of that, you ended up doing children's entertainment as well, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, more than anything. Yeah, that's right. And then, I mean, you move forward. I was doing quite reasonably well with that. Learned how to do balloons, as you know. And then you said to me, You do Punch and Judy? I said, no. He said, I've seen the puppets up at the warehouse. And I went, yeah, I bought a Punch and Judy puppet set, but I've never done it. And he said, well, I've got a gig coming up at the NEC, the Good Food Show, 3 days at X pounds a day. I went, when's this? He said, about 6 weeks' time. I said, do Punch and Judy. And so I went away and built a Punch and Judy booth. I knew nothing about Punch and Judy. And Ron Popple, darling Ron, taught me his Punch and Judy show. And I went and did that job for you, pretty badly, but got through it. You know, I think we all got paid.
The client was happy. I remember it.
Okay. I mean, your magic show left a lot to be desired, as far as I recall. But I can't hear you. How many times are you going to say that? I can't hear you. I can't hear you. That's the first 15 minutes of your act. I can't hear you. But until the kids can't shout it. Interesting concept. Funny. And Punch and Judy, I mean, I've done more and more of it. And this summer, you know, since the Queen, God bless her, Jubilee thing, done more of that than anything else, out all the time. So that was kind of a bit of luck that you asked me that day to do it. Not part of a plan. Once again, never had a plan to do it. I do enjoy doing it now. I've learned on the shows. Chris Somerville from the Harlequin Puppet Theatre in North Wales, amazing puppeteer. He taught me a lot. He also tore me apart for 2 days. So I came away thinking, I can't do this. Chris pulls no punches, but he's brilliant. And he was right. He's always right. Bit like me in that respect.
I want to talk more about Albion magic and puppets and everything. But first of all, you mentioned earlier on, and I want to swing back to this, that you spent a year touring with Ken Dodd. Now, how did that come about?
Well, it was Derek Lever, actually. I think, I can't tell you the year, but do you remember the guy that they've had at Blackpool twice with all the birds, all the weird birds, hundreds of birds, ducks running around? Well, Ken Dodd used to use him on his show, and I can't remember the guy's name. Anyway, apparently his van had broken down, and he couldn't do two nights at Malvern. I can't remember the name of the theatre. And Ken had gone, and his usual, I mean, Danny Hunt's Amethyst did a lot, you know, and there's a couple of other illusion acts did a lot for Ken. And they're ideal fit for the show, to be honest with you. And he said, I want an act. And he went to Derek Lever, and he said, try Alec Powell. So I had this phone call. I was down at the warehouse working on one of the circus lorries, and he said, this boy said, hello, Ken Doddy. I went, yeah, very funny. Who's that? Hello, Ken Doddy. I said, I won't tell you exactly what I said, but... But I said, just off, who is it? And he went, it's Ken Dodd. I went, Ken Dodd, can we start this conversation again? And I wandered out of the warehouse into the road outside. And he said, yes. I said, I'm sorry, Ken, I'm sorry. Hang on a second. I'm standing in the middle of the road at the moment. And he said, I'm looking for a magician, not a bloody crossing warden. I went, oh. So anyway, so... He said he wanted me to do two nights the following night and the night after. So I did two nights for him in Malvern. And over the next year to 18 months, I think, I wasn't with him all the time because there was, you know, often he could get somebody decent. And just when he couldn't, I did his show. Amazing experience, amazing, you know, brilliant. What a bloke. What an act. Never got any of the family to see, because everywhere we ever went, it was sold out. You know, difficult gig for my kind of act. Bears and some mine, it was a sort of brainless knockabout comedy sort of act. Bear in mind, the audience, who are of a certain age, have come in. You know, the show started at 7:30. At 10:30, the interval starts. They've usually had the chocolate and gone to bed by then. So then there's a 15-minute interval. Ken goes to 35 minutes. That gives him a 45-minute break. Have a little bit of a rest and a cup of tea and whatever. And you go out there, it's now 11:15, 10 to 11 or whatever. And this audience are very tired. They've already had 3 hours of Ken as well. They're going, who the hell is this? And I'm going, ha, welcome to my world of mystery and illusion and all that cobblers. And it was a, but I mean, luckily they're nice audience. They were in they're polite audience anyway. So sometimes it went well, sometimes it didn't go so well, but you got through it. Once I cut it short, Ken went bananas because I've cut it off, I can't do this anymore. It was a snowy night. I'd done a kid's show earlier in the day, 2 foot of snow, and the audience had somehow got there, or most of them. And dying on my arse. So I'd cut it short by 5 minutes. He went ballistic because he wasn't ready, because Ken was such a pro. You know, if he said do 3 minutes, it was 3 minutes, 8 minutes, eight, 25, 3 hours. He knew exactly what he was doing. He could tell you exactly how long that show was going to be. He'd walk into the theatre and his lady Anne would say, issues with overtime here. That show would come in within the, before the overtime race kicked in. Absolute technician, brilliant bloke, fantastic talent. And, you know, that was really, I suppose, the biggest thing I ever did, even though I didn't do particularly well.
Well, your act, and you know, let's talk about this. I've said to anybody who listens, I think that your act is hilarious. It's very Tommy Cooper-esque. Things are exploding, things are happening. I think the thing that you do with the ventriloquist doll is so funny. The moment where the thing explodes when you're not looking at it, all this sort of stuff is hilarious. Like it does feel a little Tommy Cooper-esque. Did
Well,
you go down that route? Yeah.
people say that, and it's like the kiss of death to say that because Cooper himself was a comedy genius, and nobody wants to really be compared with him, least of all me. And the thing I'd say is, I mean, obviously I love Cooper. There was another comedy magician, black country guy called Dennis Beards, who was funnier than Tommy Cooper. Unbelievably funny. I mean, achingly funny. But what I happened on to is that I did a convention in Ireland, and we were sitting at breakfast after the show the night before, and one of the Irish guys there said, "I love your act, just like Tommy Cooper." And Pat Page, my biggest hero in magic, Pat Page said, "No, Alec is nothing like Tommy Cooper, because Alec does tricks that actually work." And amongst all, and I never really thought or analysed it, because I desperately wanted to not be Tommy Cooper, because you can't, it's like, oh, I'm Tommy Cooper, I am, I'm funny, I am, like, you know, so people say, I'm mad, I am, I'm mad. And you know what? No, I didn't want to be Tommy Cooper, but I liked what he did, you know, and I wanted, obviously. I mean, there are other acts like, what the hell are they called now? Oh, there's an act for America, Cole and Company. Cole and Company. I mean, probably Nick more off them than anybody else, but certainly with Amnesia. Such a funny act. You ever seen them?
No, never.
Oh, Cole and Co. Hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. Like, there's so many little bits to it. Like, his assistant, very glam, you know, in a blowsy sort of way, chewing gum. Our girls used to do that. And he'd go, and she'd take the gum out and put it in his hand. And he'd pull his lapel back on his dress suit. It's a big row of gum all the way down. He'd just stick another one on. So you've become derivative of a lot of things. I mean, the exploding budgie box that you mentioned, that's Derek Lever made it. He let me make it, so I'm making there. But Cooper used that. What I'm told he didn't know how to set it, how to have somebody set it for him. bit dangerous. Explosives are, you know.
Yeah, they really are. That bang that it makes in your show, just every single, even though I know when it's coming,
I blew a side of the box into the audience once in the circus and hit a kid on the head. So I compensation of a spinning plate covered it in those days. And I put threads on them after that. Stop it going too far. And we had you remember I did a cannon thing at Blackpool? No? I dropped a girl in a cannon and fired her allegedly across the stage, across the speed camera. That was the speed camera gag.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to bring that up. That's an amazing bro.
Yeah. I made quite a few of them, you know. The speed camera gag, which was basically you go, I like to take a photograph of every audience I appear in front of. And unfortunately, tonight I came out without the camera, but don't worry, I've managed to borrow one. And I thought it had finished, but even with them switched off, it still works, you know. Obviously, it's not in view until you put it out. And then you get a guy to come up and you go, would you pass across the front of the camera? And you know, and they walk over and you go, mate, it's going to be more than 40 miles an hour. And they go, all right, they see that. Be careful. This is some very expensive equipment at the side of the stage. If you think you're going to run to that, veer off and throw yourself at the wall. Anyway, stuff like that. And then he comes back and he flashes. I won't do the whole thing, but just the general idea of it. And so I thought I'm going to make one or two to sell. And I made one for Joe Pasquale. And somebody said, why did you do that? Because he'll put it on his next DVD. And I said, because he'll put it on his next DVD anyway, but at least I'll have the money for making it. So, and Joe bought one off me. And that's in February at Blackpool. He picked it up. In May, one Friday night, the phone went about 6:30, and this voice went, hello? And I went, who's that? And, you know, his voice is so distinctive. And he went, I'm going to use a speed camera. I said, yeah. He said, I can't remember how it works. I said, when are you going to use it? He said, in about an hour's time. I said, so, Joe, great, another great talent, very funny man.
Yeah, he is. And yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, through Albion Magic, you as well as selling the Terry and Norma range, you've developed your own props, you've built illusions for big names, you've built illusions for me, you've built, I might be wrong, but aren't you responsible for Richard Jones's card sword?
Oh, yeah, we made the one he used on his return to VGT, yeah. Mm. I was sweating that much, I think, God. I hope this works, because it's live, wasn't it? And we'd made it so it looked like a cavalry sword. Andy Hurst had done a lot of work on that. Andy Hurst died a few months ago. Tragedy. Anyway. Great craftsman. And I think Andy and me sitting there on the edge of the set. He said, hope to God this works. And it did, so that was all right. And we relaxed. But I mean, apart from yourself, did you ever use that illusion I built for you?
Yeah, the graffiti girl, yeah. In fact, I used it last week.
Really?
I use it to make Ryland appear on stage now. In the illusion show, I come out, and the opening illusion is after I've done the warm-up, I use the graffiti girl to make Ryland appear on stage. He bursts out through the paper, and then we go into a crystal casket.
Oh, right. Well, we've done some illusions. I've not done a vast number. Our stuff isn't on the standard of Adam Topping or Guy Barrett sort of level, you know. But I think they work. There you go. Yeah, so a few bits and pieces we made.
So off the back of setting up Albion Magic, you then obviously set up Kidology. You were one of the founding organizers of Kidology, which has continued for over a decade now, 10, 15 years, I don't know how many years. You've had some of the biggest names in Magic lecture at Kidology over the years. So I suppose the question is, what made you decide to go to the trouble of setting up a convention? Because that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, can we stop for a second? Let's stop for a second.
Yeah.
Sorry, Craig.
That's all right, mate. You're doing brilliantly. And I'm loving it. I hope you're enjoying it. I'm enjoying it.
Yeah. Some of it's true.
hang on, let me just ask that question again. Here we go. So,
okay.
So I suppose the question is, you know, Kidology, what made you decide to go to the trouble of setting up a convention? Because that's a difficult thing to do. And is it awkward trying to top your previous year every single year? Because I know I've spoken to some of the organizers of Blackpool, and that's something that they always worry about. How can we make each year bigger than the year before?
Well, that's a massive issue for Blackpool. I don't know how you keep topping it. I don't know. But then things come out of the blue, didn't they, with that Arturo Brachetti show was unbelievable for me. Not everybody's taste, but the best thing I've ever seen on a stage. What an incredible show that was. But that's not what you asked me.
No, I agree.
So you never know where something extraordinary is going to crop up that you didn't think was going to be amazing. But I think you've got to understand the way things were back when we started Kidology, and it was that you had a few one-day conventions that were on the way out. There was Blackpool, still on the rise, and the IBM, which was very big, you know, the 900,000 people there. That was, so those are the two big ones. And my idea was that we create a convention that could take place in the middle of the week. Now, others have done it since, but at that point in time, it wasn't being done. I thought, well, if we want a convention for kids entertainers, it needs to be at a time that's not going to cost them work as well as the cost of going to the convention. And most of them are working at weekends, and so it seemed to me that that doing it midweek would be better, and that was the basic principle of it. But we really sweated on whether it would work or not, whether it would be supported or not, and then we just had to try it out, whether it would fit in around the IBM, because you look at the year and you've got to find a slot, and the kids entertainers are getting ready for Christmas in November, busy in the summer, August, you don't do July and August. There's Blackpool in February, nobody's got any money for 3 months after that. We were driven to September, and we thought the worst week for work is the week when the kids go back to school. So we worked around that kind of premise, which may or not have been right, but... And it took off really, really well for some years. It grew and grew, and then it stopped for various reasons. Not a subject to talk about. Anyway, but we had some great people. But for me, it was, Kidology was about, it had a mercenary objective, which was giving the dealers like us a chance to take some money. Mm-hmm. So it needed to make a profit to mean we took profit on the stands. And also needed to be some decent, some quality actor. We wanted speakers who weren't doing all the clubs, who weren't, you know, hadn't done 16 magic clubs this year, or got a new lecture. And I didn't know why the way it went afterwards, but I wanted it to be at Kidology first. Jeremy liked to get... acting from abroad was something I was never keen on, because I thought we needed to focus on people working in the industry in this country, excuse me, which is quite different to a lot of European countries, and certainly different to America, and in my opinion. doesn't mean I'm right. That was just my opinion. So we always had battles.
The best lecturer I ever saw at any kidology ever was Michael J. Fitch. It's the only time I've ever seen him do a kids lecture, and it was phenomenal.
It was amazing, wasn't it, with the monkeys, the chimpanzees, and the little bell and all that. It was a really, really good lecture. Not one that people would take much away from in terms of being able to perform, but I think it was food for thought, and it was certainly worth seeing. We've had some great ones, and I mean, some of the names are no longer with us, you know, for Alan Shackson, Pat Page, Ali Bongo. We've been through the canon, really. I think, fulfilled a function that it filled a gap that was there at the time. And we made loads of money as well, because by putting the dealers and the lectures all in the same room, because we use the Civic at Wolverhampton, a very big venue. So we got the dealers out, and shutting the dealers every time there was a lecture on created a sort of 6 o'clock rush. As soon as the lecture finished, the dealers were on, and you got maybe half an hour, and then they were shut again. And it really helped. Well, you know, because you worked for me, you know, people would come and throw money at you because they knew it was going to be shut in a minute. And that we didn't actually plan it that way, but suddenly discovered it and thought, yeah, we like this. Because that's the problem with most conventions, is that the convention itself wants to put on the best possible range of speakers and shows. And, you know, they all try to create space for the dealers, but very often it's a short time. And people want to go and get a cup of coffee or, you know, use the loo. And before you know it, the next lecture's starting. And they have to make a very conscious effort or miss something to go and have a look around the dealers, you know.
Yes, I agree.
But, you know, I think dealing has changed massively in the last 20 years.
You know, I'm not a dealer. I work with a lot of magic producers, but I'm not a dealer. But it seems to me that it would be a very unwise business decision these days to get into dealing, because 90% of dealers just carry the Murphy's items, so there's nobody standing out and being unique. And, you know, I don't know, you just look around Blackpool and I don't know, you tell me. I mean, if you weren't a dealer and you know what you know now, would you go into dealing now? I mean,
that would be completely the wrong time, unless you've got a range of your own stuff that you're manufacturing and that you're not selling to other people. That gives you a chance. But you're not going to, you know, you're not going to be able to take on, you know, the big boys, Prop Dog, Alakazam. I'm going to mention the wrong names, aren't I? Vanishing Inc. I think they're probably the three biggest hitters at the moment.
Penguin.
Yeah. So I'm going to miss somebody out and people will be offended, but you know what I'm saying. And they manufacture on a large scale. And they've all got an international presence. A lot of the sort of stuff that dealers like me used to produce, a magician now comes up with an effect, he sells it himself, he sells it on the internet or Facebook or wherever he goes, and they don't take it to a dealer. So you're left with what you produce yourself, you know, and I've not produced much new stuff in the last few years. You get lazy, a bit despondent, I suppose. And then I go to Blackpool, and I've got to be honest, Blackpool's always been very good for me, always. And it still is. And it's difficult because you've got 120 dealers or whatever. I think some dealers go to Blackpool and don't do very well, you know, because a lot of them are selling stuff that almost anybody can buy, and there's dealers running in their mom's spare bedroom. Murphy account, here we go. And I think you're right about that. So I tend to avoid most of their stuff. but not exclusively. I do sell Murphy's stuff that I don't want to make.
So what, very quickly to go back to Kidology, we're a few weeks removed of Kidology this year. What have you got planned? You know, we talked about topping it every single year. There seems to have been a big buzz about Kidology this year. What have you got going on?
Well, I kind of digressed from the point, which was that for me, I don't think it's all about getting the biggest names. It's, for me, I think Kidology is to some degree a social event. People get together, people with a, you know, common interest, as particularly as kids entertainers, it's a very solitary job. And you don't often get to meet with, there's a lot of chit chat on the internet, but actually meeting up with each other is rare. And so there's a strong social side, I think, to Kidology. I try to find subjects rather than big names that might provoke interest. And you never know. I mean, maybe I've got it wrong. This year, so on top of the bill is Steve Hewlett, who unfortunately went and did the same lecture at the IBM last week, which I'm getting lazy, I suppose. I always used to talk to people about that before. I mean, he's good. I'm still happy about him, but kind of he's available elsewhere, or has been. Well, I think
there's only a very small percentage of people that would consider coming to Kidology that were at the IBM.
Yeah, and then we've got Jezzo, who probably very few people had heard of before the Family Entertainer of the Year competition this year at Blackpool, whose father was the great Bondini. So his heritage, his pedigree, if you like, is strong. He's got a lot of knowledge of stage work, and he's as mad as a box of frogs. And I thought, you know, I think at the last minute he was put into the Family Entertainer of the Year competition, and I didn't see it, but I'm told he was a clear winner, and we'd already got him booked by then, and I was really pleased about it. So he's talking about supersizing his show, ramping it up, making it bigger, you know, getting it onto stage, I suppose. Then there's Magic Touch by JJ and Jonathan. The Magic Touch works to provide magic and entertainment for people with disabilities. Okay, we've all done a bit of it, but really blind and deaf. And then he's an amazing, JJ is amazing, the work he does. And I thought that would be something interesting to hear and note as well. Jonathan, who's with him, beat the one Blackpool pandemic. So that's encouraging inclusion. Then they've got Sammy Brooks doing.
So you broke up there. Sammy Brooks doing what?
Yeah, we've got Sammy Brooks doing it to the nth degree. He does with everything he gets involved with. But he's not just going to be talking about Sam. He's going to be talking about putting the stage show together, booking it into theatres and touring. But the focus is as a Santa show. So I thought that was interesting. I've relented after. Sorry.
He's an incredible Santa. I've seen it. It's so good.
Yeah. Well, Sammy's one of those people, whatever he does it to the nth degree, and you save hands, you know. Steve Dimmer. Now, Steve Dimmer's a very understated guy. I like him. Second time of Kidology. He's talking about 5-minute wonders and playground fads, you know, that kids have. With the spinners or what, you know, whatever comes along, and make them into tricks in your show. Steve's an interesting man. He runs a little theatre company. He's written plays. He wrote a play about St. James, which just toured, but nothing to do with this. But he's a creative guy and interesting, and not high profile, but I rate him. Marika Wallace, excuse me, is bringing Punch to the party. So I've resisted a long time having us talk about Punch and Judy because I don't want many more people doing it. but Marika makes the puppets as well. She's brilliant. So she's coming and doing, bringing basically an introduction to taking up Punch and Judy. Then we've got Darren Woodward, Daz, Mohican Daz.
Yeah.
He's doing taking her off with the smooth, and it's a close up workshop for kids. So that's the lineup, which I think was a fairly diverse range of subjects, but not all the same sort of stuff that you had heard before. And so I may be wrong, I may be right, I don't know. I don't feel that it seems to have the appeal of other agendas we put out there, but I don't know.
And
the challenge with Kidology is not finding someone better, but finding new areas to explore, because I think that's the thing.
And obviously, as well as having all of those acts, you've got the competition, haven't you? Have you got the competition again?
Yeah, we've got the UK Children's Entertainer of the Year competition. That's the day after Kidology. PJ runs that for me. And we've got an amazing trophy that moves on from year to year. And the thing about that was, I was with kids competitions that there weren't many kids there. Well, we get them bussed in. They'd come a long way, actually, but PJ's got over 100 kids being bussed in on a Wednesday morning in term time to watch the competition, you know, which is pretty good going. I think they're coming from Telford as well, which is quite a long way to the Austin Sports and Social Club. But yeah, we went away from the original judging system. We've got four judges now, and I think they'll get the right result. It's always subjective, you know, what do you like at the end of the day?
That's it. Wow. And where can people go to get tickets to this year's Kidology?
Well, we've got a website, kidologyuk.co.uk, I think it's called, yeah. That tells you what's going on and everything about it, and, you know, dealers that are there, social events may have to be curtailed due to, you know, what's happened, sadly happened with the Queen. In fact, who knows which way it's going to go, because we were starting on the Monday the 19th, and it looks like that might be the day of her funeral, if that's the case. I don't know, it's all up in the air at the moment. But yeah, kidologyuk.co.uk, that sends you to the Albion website, and then you click and get it, you know me. Technology, never get it right. Anyway, you click again, you pay for it there. Or you can ring me up. I'll come round and take the money off you.
And you are right, Kidology, I've been many, many times. I'm going this year again. And you are right. It's very very much a social thing as well. As well as, you know, there's great lectures on, but it is social, seeing people that are like-minded, because it is really just kids entertainers and you know, reconnecting, and it is a very social situation.
Well, you know, I mean, and the night before, I don't know what's going to happen, but we were having Sammy Brooks doing karaoke, Jezzo doing his search for a new assistant, and God knows what was going to happen with that, or it may still. And then on the night of Kidology, we've got a DJ on, and there's a cabaret with Amethyst and a singer, used to be in my boys' brigade company actually, Eddie G, and like a crooner, and Steve Hewlett. So there's a nice little cabaret on as well on the night of Kidology.
That's great.
All being well, who knows?
Hopefully.
Strange times. And so, yeah, go on. Yeah,
no, go on, go on.
No, no. You go on.
I was just going to say, and on top of all of this that we've talked about, you created one of the most popular events in the Midlands in the UK, which is the car boot sale.
Ha!
Which isn't a car boot sale. Anybody who's listening to this, especially from abroad, that yeah. maybe a car boot sale being selling out of a car boot. That's not the case. It's actually kind of more an event where there's dozens of dealers and smaller dealers and some You know, medium sized even.
Yeah, well, we started that when I got the old circus warehouse, and we used to have it in there. It used to be really cold, but yeah, we thought people like to get want to raise money just before Blackpool or just before the IBM. So we did 2 a year, and we've done that for over it's over 25 years now, and different venues here and there. But yeah, people come and sell their own gear, and we've got one this weekend, all being well, on the 11th of September. 30 stalls booked in.
Right.
Yeah, and a lot of good deals move backwards and forwards. You know, and you find there's some of the dealers sell stuff to each other. But yeah, that's been going again. That's a sort of social. A lot of people come to that for a cup of coffee and a bacon sandwich, really. It's a get together as much as
That's the
anything
very first place that I took Ryland,
else.
convention, the first place I took him to
Yeah.
was the car boot sale. And I remember him walking in, he was only about six or seven, and he was
Yeah.
going
Huh.
away. He was absolutely blown away. And
Yeah, it's just.
you tend to find that there's a lot of hidden gems, you know, if you start mooching around a lot of the stores, the stuff that you wouldn't find anywhere else.
You never know what's going to be there, you know. And some people sell it at really good prices, you know. It's a car boot sale. That's why although it's always been indoors, we call it a car boot sale, and it's discouraged all the people from using the same name. Tabletop sale sounds, which is what it is, sounds a bit dry, isn't it? Boring.
And for many years, my favourite part of the whole thing was the bacon sandwiches.
Yeah, we used to cook them ourselves. We can't do that anymore. Somebody else has the catering rights. But yeah, the breakfast used to be really good. There you go.
So, right, we've talked about everything that you've done through your career. We've talked about, you know, starting off, we've talked about circuses, we've talked about selling circuses, setting up your own show, becoming a kids entertainer, winning competitions, working with Ken Dodd, setting up Albion Magic, building illusions, going to conventions as a dealer, all of this stuff, setting up Kidology. We've talked about the car boot sale. What's the plan moving forward, Alec? Is there anything else that you want to do
I
or?
told I Craig, I already told you I don't do plans. I don't do plans. I really don't. I think, you know, as I'm getting older now, maybe it's time to just take a bit of time out and do some less active things. I'm getting less active by the day. I'll be on a bloody Zimmer frame soon. I don't know. I've done quite a lot with equity over the last 10 years or so, but that I'm in the process of falling out with equity at the moment. So that curtain may be coming down on that one as well. I don't know, Craig. I've blagged my way. I've kind of blagged my way through life from the first day in the law to the last day in the dealer's hall at the IBM. I've just blagged my way through. Never been particularly good at anything. Always gave the impression of knowing more than I actually did. Like you do, really. And
This is my MO that you're talking about here.
no. You're very good at what you do. No, I just I've been an imposter in most situations, to be honest with you, because I've never properly focused on one thing at a time, as you can gather from this rambling discussion we've had. And I still keep I'm in touch with one or two people in the law. In fact, one of the most senior judges in the country, whose name I won't mention, but one of the six most senior judges was a is a friend of mine, and we still keep in touch occasionally. He's a genius of a bloke. Still see him in the law reports, you know. Did his birthday party at his country estate some years ago, and he said 2 days before he phoned, he said it's only fair to tell you because there's only going to be like 15 people at this party. He said, I wasn't going to mention it, but I think it's only fair to give you a warning. But Princess Anne's going to be here with Captain Lawrence, Commander Lawrence. I went, oh God. So, and me doing close up with Princess Anne. I did Richard Pinner's kids' cards. I said, let me see those cards. I said, you must be joking. And put them in the pocket. That was the end of our relationship, I think.
But you say you blagged your way through things and not being particularly good at it. Just to flip that around on its head, just for a second. If I told anybody who was getting into magic now that by the time you, I'm not going to say reach the end of the career, but by the time you've been in this world for a very long time, you would have won numerous competitions, won the IBM, won Blackpool, arguably the two biggest competitions in the UK, won multiple comedy awards, travelled and had your own circus for years, worked with Ken Dodd for years, set up still one of the biggest conventions in the UK that continues to this day, performed literally all over the world. You've done, built props for people like Joe Pasquale. You've done a hell of a lot, Alec. You really have. I mean, if you took a percentage of what you've achieved in your career and said to somebody, your average magician, would you like to achieve this by the end of your career? They would have said, yes, absolutely, 100%. So if your definition of blagging it and getting along is doing all of that, then, you know, that's okay with me.
I know. I don't think I'd recommend people to do that. They'd be better off following your pattern, focusing on particular things and working hard at that, rather than every 10 years moving into a new field that you know nothing about. Yeah. Interesting and challenging, sometimes very expensive, cost me a lot of money. Happily, my wife isn't listening, or if she might be at the door. No, but I don't know. It's been, yeah. Some of it's been really good, and some of it's been really difficult. So there you go.
What was your favourite thing out of it? Before we wrap this interview up, what was the favourite period of your career? Was it being a magic dealer? Was it working the circus? Was it being an amethyst? Was it Punch and Judy? What was it?
I don't know, really. I don't know, because each of them have got a high spot, which were brilliant, you know? And then they've got low spots that weren't. And so I never thought about that, really, to be able to give you a sensible answer. Obviously, you know, working with Ken Dodd was amazing, but appearing in front of his audience wasn't particularly easy, you know? And I can't answer the question, really. And I've never really thought about it, because I'm moving on to the next thing all the time. Mm. Did you see these ladybird eggs at the IBM?
Oh, man. And you said that you're not very good at close-up.
I'm not. That's just rubbish, isn't it? Do it better this time, right? Ladybird egg. That's it.
That's cool. Mate.
How's Ryan?
He's very good. He's very good. He loved the IBM.
How's his spinning plate coming on?
He practices every day. He's now able to throw it from one stick to another and back. Yeah, he's nailing it 100%. Yeah, he's doing well. Alec, this has been an incredible interview. It has. I'm really honoured. I know you don't do interviews very often, if at all. And I really wanted to talk to you about everything that you've achieved, because I don't think people that are new in magic that come into a dealer hall at Blackpool and they see the Albion Magic stand and they see you standing behind there, they don't realise everything that you've done. They don't realise that just a decade or so before, you were standing in the opera house winning the competition, the stage.
Well, I've got to correct you. I didn't win the overall. I only won the comedy section, because people will take issue with that. I never won the overall thing. And well, the point is, Craig, most of the things you talked about only matter to me. The fact that I've done this, that, or the other doesn't really matter to some young guy that's coming in and wants to be, you know, Dynamo or what's his name? Can't remember David names. No, I was going to say Derren Brown.
Derren Brown.
Yeah, you know, so what I've done really doesn't interest them. And I understand that. It's okay. I'm not known for being particularly... I'm not think I'm a good retailer, to be honest with you. I don't think I was cut out for retail. Joe Pasquale came and stood by the store. Could you buy bits and pieces off me? And he kept standing there. Do you want anything else? He said, no, I'll serve it away. I said, do you want anything else? I said, what are you doing there? He said, I just love the way you talk to these people. And PJ and Shane, who helped me out of Blackpool, keep threatening to have some badges done that say, Alec Powell told me personally to F off. I got a low boredom threshold, I suppose. I really don't care how they do that trick. And they walk past them, go, I say they, some magician walk past and go, ho, 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 look at Stanley, go, ho, ho, I don't need any of this. I've got cupboards full of it at home. What are you telling me for? What? Do you go down Tesco and say, ha, you see all that bread? You can stick that up your arse. I've got plenty already. You don't do it. But why do they come round? I don't need any of that. Well, clear off then. What the, this is a museum exhibit. Oh, I'll tell you what. They say, show me that, and I go. You do it, and then they go. Now, what I do? So, A, they're not going to buy it, and now they're going to show you because they've already got it. What they do with it, and you don't want to see it because you're there to take money. So, yeah, I suppose I do get a bit irritable sometimes.
I've worked dealer stands, as you know, many, many years. And yeah. Honestly, and I've actually said this on the channel, by the end of Blackpool on day three, I'm ready to headbutt somebody off the balcony. Like, if I have a person turn around to me and go, I'll come back later. I'll think about it. I might go postal and just snap, like, seriously.
You feel like saying, look, just open your wallet. Let's have a look. You haven't got enough money to buy it. Clear off. No, it's very rude. And, you know, I do have some very loyal customers who, you know, they come and buy some off me that I know they don't want or need, but just because they like to help me out. I look poor and needy. But I also have had enough by the end of the day. You come into the show tonight? Beat the wand. Oh, go down the Ruskin. There is a hell. I know. It's like hell. The Ruskin is welcome to hell. Or you hear cards being riffled. Oh, look at this, look at this. And, you know, oh, no. The last time I was in there, we were going, we'd get a glass and three or four of us would stand. I don't know who was with me. Trouble wags anyway. We got a glass and get in the middle of the reception and just wait to get a bit quiet and just drop a 50 pence piece in the glass. And everybody around you goes, no, I don't believe it. What? Suddenly you've got a crowd all around you. I'll tip it out and go, go get me a pack of crisps, will you? Ruskin, oh my God. I cannot think of anywhere I would rather be less. But there you go. People love it, so good luck to them. My first job in Blackpool is to find out which pubs are not being used by magicians, and that's where I go.
That's funny.
No. Very rude, isn't it? Really. The problem is that a lot of magicians are magicians because they're socially inadequate, and because of it's their passport to talking to people and interacting with people. You take the tricks away and they're not very interesting people to talk to. This is going on too long.
This is dull. No. It's true. Max Maven once said most people that get involved in magic were bullied at school, and they got involved in magic to give them something that they could do that kind of made them stand out.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I was bullied at school actually. Yeah, you're right.
Most magicians are.
Interesting. Max Maybe, what a clever bloke. Strange, but clever. Yeah.
It's weird. it's very weird. But aren't we all? Alec, this has been incredible. Genuinely been incredible. I want people to go and book onto Kidology. If you are.
Oh, that'd be nice, yeah.
You're a children's entertainer, or you've got an interest in children's entertaining. And you know, you're free on September the.
Well, it looks like the 20th if the Queen's funeral's on the 19th. The main day is the 20th, anyway.
Yeah, the evening of the 19th. Hopefully, the main day's on the 20th, and then the competition's on the 21st.
That's right. Yeah, who knows? Anyway, it's always been a pleasure speaking to you, Craig. This I predict will have your lowest viewing figures of any program you put out, certainly after the first 5 minutes.
Some of the most popular interviews that I've done are people like Chris North, Mark Leverage, Peter Nardi, Sean.
Yeah, but those are all quite significant people that have contributed a lot to magic, you know, over the years. And so I think it's a bit different than me, you know.
Tell you who, before we wrap this up, I'll tell you who I'm trying to track down, and no one seems to know where he is, because I'd love to interview him. It was a big part of my journey of magic. Stephen Tucker, falling off the planet, Alex.
Yeah, I think Stephen just walked away and said thank you and good night. He was never a great one for socialising anyway. I mean, any convention he was at, as soon as it shut, Stephen would disappear. You wouldn't see him till the next day. Lovely guy. I don't know, but he lived in Malvern, I think.
He did, yeah.
That's where you need to start looking. His wife Maggie was doing tarot and palm. That's another thing I did, actually. Tarot, palm reading, and graphology. With Keith, the Black Heart. Yeah, the Black Heart. Brilliant guy. Yeah, we used to do haunted house nights as well.
I remember Pam and John sending us to a horse box in the middle of nowhere. In the middle of nowhere. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I know. I did it more than once as well. No, but I did quite a lot of tarot and palm reading, graphology. That was down to Keith Hart and a brilliant system he devised. You see there again. Blagged my way through that. And then he did his haunted house night as the Black Heart, and I was the family retainer, mange, and I waited on him at the table and, you know, all that. And did a bit of a show afterwards. So.
Wow. Like I say, we've only just scratched the surface. You've literally done so much. I could probably spend the next hour talking about stuff that you've done, that you've forgotten, that you didn't remember. You know, you've done so much crazy stuff.
Yeah, there you go.
Like I say, I want everyone to go and get tickets for Kidology and go check out the Magic website. The entire Terry and Norman range is on there, along with a whole bunch of other stuff.
Everything's more or less out of stock at the moment. The website needs a bit of work doing it. You know me, Craig.
Yeah.
I am to technology what you are to ballet dancing.
Yes, 100%. But you can see what's on the. My advice is have a look on the Albion Magic website.
The Kidology site's got most on, that's up to date, and it's
okay.
Lisa Oakley does a great job with it, and I don't do the thing with it.
And if you want something, then give Alec a call and you can probably make it to order.
Yes.
But so I'm gonna put the links down below to all the websites and your social media. I'm gonna put gonna put a link down below to absolutely everything I can think of. But Alec, seriously, one more time, I'm honoured and proud to call you a friend, and I want to thank you for coming on the channel. Seriously,
I was hoping you wouldn't mention that. Actually, being a friend of yours is a double-edged sword. Yes, okay, Craig.
Yeah, you're not the first person to say that. But Alec, thank you very much, mate. I'm so glad you were able to do this interview. I want everybody who's watching this to leave a comment down below. I'm sure Alec won't watch the comments, but we'll tell them about him. Tell him about them. But yeah, Alec, thank you, my friend.
Okay, cheers. Thank you, Craig.
Okay, guys, we'll see you again soon right here on Magic TV.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast.
Magic, magic.
Be
magic.
Sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel.
Magic TV.
Which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic Podcast.